All right, you ready to go?
I am.
All right, welcome everybody to this episode of the Renegade HPG podcast. This is Travis, and today my guest is James Ernest. James is the owner and lead designer of Cheap Ass Games and has a little bit of unique insight into some Battletech history, which we're going to kind of start our conversation off with today and use that as kind of a jumping off point to talk about game design in general. But James, I pulled your name. There was a little thread on the Battletech CCG Facebook page, which was a letter that you had written probably two decades ago, talking about the early development of Battletech CCG and kind of how you were involved in the first iteration of that game before kind of a legal and stuff was caused it to be scrapped and turned over to Richard Garfield, who was the eventual designer. So I'm a little curious. I've done some more content on the Battletech CCG to get, and you know, I think the people in the group would have a little bit of a kind of, you know, fun little trip down history lane and kind of see maybe a what if, you know, what that game looked like.
It's been so long.
Yeah.
I think that letter might know more than I do.
I should bring it up as kind of a reference here, but yeah. So what I was gathering from it was that you know, you guys had mostly a fully formed game, you know, built and sort of ready to go.
Before. Yeah. So I'm going entirely on seat of the pants recollection here. For instance, I don't recall writing that letter, but I recall sure. writing a fairly more angrily worded letter to some higher ups at Wizards. But yeah. No, to sort of just restate what you did, in the early days of Magic the Gathering, the Gen Con, when they released it in 93, Wizards employees went around to all of the big game publishers at the time and said, hey, let's work together. Let's do a deal because this trading card game thing is going to work out. And we want the next one we make to be even bigger. And so they signed a bunch of licenses, including Battletech and Netrunner and Vampire the Masquerade, and thought that one of those games had the potential, being a licensed game, to be even bigger than Magic. Of course, mm-hmm. you know, fast forward to 6 or 8 months later, and it's right. like, well, we're flying with this elephant on our back now. We have Magic is doing just fine without a license, but we have contracts and we have to make all these other games. And it turned into from, and this, you know, this is just my recollection of it, but it turned from an opportunity for growth to a serious paperweight. And so over those next few months and years, they fulfilled their contractual obligations to make the Netrunner game and the Battletech game and the Vampire game. And I was working at Wizards first as a freelancer, as a technical writer and graphic designer, and then in-house as essentially same. And so I had a desk in the newsletter department. And once in a while, someone from Wizards would walk past my desk and say, hey, you design games, right? And I'm like, can you help me with this project? And one of those times was Glenn Elliott, who had been given the Battletech CCG. So Glenn was, I believe, one of Peter's old friends, Peter Atkinson's friends from a previous employment, and came aboard to work on the business end of making board games. They had done a little internal contest, I guess, or I don't know, a request for proposals internally to say who among us can make this Battletech CCG. Glenn had taken that job, had done a fully functional first draft, but then sort of felt stuck. And that was when he came by my desk and said, what can you do for me? So at that point, I became essentially a freelancer under him to do support work, make playtest cards and make suggestions on rules and so forth, and do internal playtesting of this Battletech card game, which we did for about a month. And then at least the way I heard it, essentially Fossa got word of this arrangement and said, no, this contract that we have with you says that Richard Garfield is going to design this game. And so Wizards said to Glenn, sorry, you can't have this job anymore. And Glenn was like, okay, you're still paying me, so whatever.
Yeah.
And that meant that I got fired off that project too. So for all the worst reasons, the game that we made technically didn't come out. But then, of course, being the same property and based on what little everyone knew about trading card games at the time, the final project was reasonably similar to the one that we had made. The only difference being that our names weren't on it and we didn't get paid.
Oh boy. Well, hopefully you got paid till the time that they let you go. But
I was just freelancing for Glint. So no, I made zero money on that project.
Oh my goodness.
It was more, you know, when you're new in the industry and trying to get work, you do a lot of stuff on spec and things fall apart sometimes. So that's, I mean, terrible, but that's how it went.
I'm curious, if you even remember so long ago, but any kind of core mechanics that kind of stood out or more themes in the game?
I am racking my brain as to how that thing worked. The one thing that I remember that I think we did in our game, mm-hmm. and see, I haven't played the new BattleTech game, so you can tell me if this is the way it's by new. I mean, the one that happened 2 months later.
Right. Well, that's good because you can't claim your piggybacking, right? If you haven't played the new game, then anything you come up with, that's the same. We know
exactly. I need to claim ignorance on all counts. I've never looked at the patent office. I've never played another board game in my life. That's to start from that. The one thing that I think I took away from our BattleTech CCG construction was that we did a game where instead of in Magic the Gathering, where you have several phases in a row, all packed into the same turn, we tried a game where you could pick one of those phases and just do that. And it meant that the turn went back and forth a lot faster. But the only reason that I know that is because I did a similar thing in a CCG that I made through CheapAss, which was called Fight City. Okay. So I can talk about Fight City with a little more clarity. In that game, there is essentially three different types of turns that you can take. Mm-hmm. It is not a draw phase followed by a play, a construction phase followed by a fighting phase. It's one of those three things. And it means you could take three fighting phases in a row, except that the other guy gets three turns too. And I think that made the game a lot faster. Generally speaking, this is just knowledge that we know from designing all kinds of board games. But if you take a multi-phase turn and break it up into many smaller turns, the game just goes faster. Everyone gets through it quicker. And so that was an interesting experiment in BattleTech. It turned into a thing that I did in Fight City, and it's a thing that I would love to see again in a future project.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that concept, from having played Star Wars Destiny when that was out of that back and forth, and just how engaged it kind of kept you. And it's interesting you point that out, because for me, when I'm playing board games in general, that's kind of the biggest draw or turnoff for me is kind of just that downtime while you're waiting for other people, and kind of, it seems like
the more they can do on their turn, the less you can even plan for yours, especially if it's a big interactive game where I don't really know what the lay of the land is going to be until literally my turn starts. So that downtime is critical. If, just sort of game design 101, if you're designing a game for a lot of people, mm-hmm. let them all take their turn at the same time, right? I mean, that's how RoboRally works, for instance. We all do most of our thinking simultaneously, and then there's an execution phase that's sort of basic, barely turn-based, but we're all really going all at once. And that keeps everyone engaged all the time. Whereas if you played, say, Magic with five people, which we certainly did a lot of back then, mm-hmm. that's 4x downtime. That's just looking at your cards and waiting for 20 minutes.
Yeah. Do you remember, with that original iteration, was the focus kind of on heavily on mechs? And do you remember how you kind of, translated those mechs to the cards? And, one thing, if, looking back for myself, if I had a chance to kind of redo and reapproach the game, it would almost take it more like how the Star Wars CCG went, where you could decide if you wanted vehicle based or starship based or planet and character based. And BattleTech kind of has a very similar balance, certainly in the lore, in terms of a full balance between the characters and the richness of the characters, as well as the technology and equipment. And it seemed like the game that Richard eventually came up with, the characters were very much kind of a side thing, and not even to a degree playable at a certain level, because they just didn't blend very well with the mechs. And I'm curious if your original iteration, how you kind of dealt with that, if you even remember kind of the question.
I think, and again, this is 25-year-old plus reckoning here, but yeah. I remember all the cards, and they were mechs. They were straight up mechs. And it was, I think when you're going to do a game that doesn't bloat, you want to pick a cross section and play that thing. Yeah. So yeah, I agree. Like, the stories are great. And even the planetary level conflicts are interesting, but I think as a metagame, that might work, but as all part of the same layered game, that's a lot to pack in, especially if you want a game that plays fast. So yeah, we had mechs deploying in ranks, jumping out of your hand and into play and being, you know, in the front or the back end and having ranged attacks and things like that. I mean, it was very much on the sort of combat unit level. Each card was a mech, basically.
Definitely. Yeah, and I just, that back and forth is interesting because then how it translates the tabletop, because the tabletop has initiative and basically people take turns back and forth, and that's something that did not get translated into Richard's final version, you know, where it is kind of one person goes through the whole turn.
You shouldn't think of a CCG as an adaptation of an existing game mechanic. It's more, this is a new game mechanic that tells a similar story, right? So in this trading card game world, I want to be able to carry a deck in my pocket and sit down in a line at a convention and play a game in 10 minutes with a friend of mine, like on the floor. And so chop, chop, you don't have a lot of time. You don't have a lot of rules. You don't even have a lot of space. Again, this is the theoretical envelope in which CCGs are being developed in 1994, right? It's still a real quick play pocket size game. And so, yeah, you have to pick a cross section and do that.
I'm curious, you know, and a little insight into that history. You know, you were really on the ground level of kind of the explosion of the, you know, the card game. You know, what, you know, any insights that you can kind of share from that? And I'm curious kind of how it shaped your personal development kind of as you grew at Wizards and then, you know, eventually came into Cheap Ass Games.
Yeah, well, building Magic decks taught me how to build decks for anything. So a board game that has a deck of cards in it, everything that you learn about how many of each card to put in and what to expect in a random shuffle and, you know, how the cards interact and, you know, more rare cards and less common cards or backwards. Like everything you learn about building decks in a CCG, just as a player, it strongly informs how you construct new decks for games that have similar behaviors, whether they're constructible or just fix, right? But like Kill Dr. Lucky was one of the first products that I did through Cheap Ass Games, and that's got a deck of 96 cards, and the balance of weapons and failure cards and move cards and so on, like the way those cards are distributed through that deck is informed by how I learned how to build Magic decks. I know that sounds like oversimple, like of course you can make a deck of cards for a card game without like needing to know how to make a CCG, but I think that was kind of my invitation to a better level of game design, like just sort of understanding how to build Magic decks is a huge deal.
Right. And in the modern, you know, card game landscape, you know, there's a strong pairing between draft play and constructed play. And I'm curious kind of how and when that kind of evolved from the game design aspect and when, I guess, you guys were forced to really kind of consider in that playtesting design developments of those two different formats and how they interact with each other and how to kind of design cards that could be effective in both.
Well, to be fair, I was never part of you guys. I was always kind of on the outside of that. I know what I can say about how it evolved, looking essentially from next door, but I was not on any design team for a Magic expansion. We certainly tried to be. In fact, one of my earliest pitches to Wizards was a CCG for kids, which they initially asked for. And then, like I said, with all the obligations that they had already signed up for, they realized they couldn't make it. Yeah. So that was a disappointment, but that's as close as I got. I certainly like was play testing all of those sets, but I wasn't a designer on any of them. The closest thing I got to design at Wizards was compiling a list of multiplayer variants for the Pocket Player's Guide. The booklet that came out with Revised, maybe around about that time.
Okay. So Revised, that was the fourth one, Alpha, Beta, Unlimited Revised. Yeah.
Sounds right. You know, just speaking to the development of draft play and that, it seems like in an environment where you're perpetually buying the game and the person with the most cards has the best choice. And, you know, essentially the theory becomes that the moneyed players win.
Yeah.
The notion of playing from a fixed set of starter components so have a level playing field again is kind of like the notion of table stakes poker, right? Everyone can only buy in for $2. Mm. That's what you have to play with. Make the most of that. Yeah. And that translates to CCGs as saying, okay, I have every card in your collection. You've been collecting them longer than I have. There's no way I'm catching up. So instead, let's start with a new, you know, we all know we're going to buy some of the new sets. So let's all buy X amount of the new set and play with that. And that'll be fair again. As a CCG designer, you have to say, okay, well, we know now that people are playing that way. And so we're even more terrified than ever of cards which individually are so out of whack that whoever gets that card just wins the draft, right?
Right. Definitely. And, you know, Tata, I'm curious about your evolution kind of in your own and where you took that experience at Wizards into your own experience and you know, maybe use that as a chance to tell us a little bit about Cheap Ass Games and kind of what that company's been focused on and the type of games that you've been developing since.
Well, Cheap Ass came out of a pitch that I actually did to other game companies at the time, including Wizards. And the pitch was sort of a Razer and Razer Blades or PlayStation and discs kind of approach, where you would sell a box of high quality game components that were generic enough to use for lots of board games. So it really started around that tackle box, that $100 box of poker chips, play money, tokens, pawns, dice that you buy once. And then the board games that played with it would cost like 15 or 20 bucks.
Yeah.
Like it was an investment that eventually paid off in lots of fungible games. It was a pitch, you know, it didn't get any interest. And then I found myself not at Wizards and freelancing with a lot of games that I wanted to sell and no real way to sell them. Not a lot of, you know, clout in the industry or friends that could, you know, bootstrap a dozen games out of my briefcase. And so I said, okay, I'll just make them myself. The Cheap Ass Games idea started with that Razor and Razor Blades thing, except I couldn't afford to make the Razor. And so I just started making the blades and said, all right, people, you probably have dice in your house. Like many other in developments in game marketing over the last 50 years, that was based on my experience with D&D, right? D&D sold the books separate from the dice, and you go get your miniatures and your dice and your whatevers. We just sell you the books. And so Cheap Ass was kind of the same way. We're just going to sell you the boards and the rules and the things that this game desperately needs, and we're going to craft them to use generic components like dice that if you have nice dice, great. If you have terrible dice, great too. But whatever it is, we're not going to deal with it. It's your problem. And that was a way for me to essentially bootstrap a game company with no money. To print my first products on my laser printer and put them in envelopes that I got at the Office Depot and take them to a con and cross my fingers.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, just, I've been, think for me and Renegade HPG, so many of the conversations I have are just kind of looking at behind the scenes for that creative process. And I'm curious at kind of the challenges that you face and what you've learned and how you've learned it in your own developments, through the game design. And I know, there's the BattleTech fandom is big enough now that there's certainly enough people who have thought, kind of about, have this idea for a game, and I think, well, everybody has ideas. I always say kind of there's a big difference between having an idea and executing on an idea. But for those that have that idea and maybe have that ambition to kind of execute, what have you learned along the way in terms of translating and the kind of do's and don'ts for kind of those early gamers and how to get started?
I think if you want to get started as a game designer, the first thing you need to do very intentionally is to separate your desire to design games from your desire to design games you can sell. And the reason that I say that is we all sort of are exposed to a culture of retail products. And that's how we see, and I'm not successful in making a game unless it winds up on the shelf at my local game store. But yeah. I think that is such a big extra that weighs you down. It's like saying that I want to make a AAA video game or I want to make a feature film. Like, of course you do want to make those things eventually, but you can't do it all at once. You can't go to film school and hope and expect to make the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's like way out of your league, right? And similarly, making a Gloomhaven, not just mechanically, but like the physical components and the marketing and the presentation and the distribution and the business back end of that is so much nastier than just make a game that you can enjoy playing with your friends. And so like, that's the first thing I try to teach people is that your first customer is you, your second customer is the people you play every day. And way down the line, your customers are going to be, publishers and distributors and retail stores and honest to God customers, right? But yeah. if you if you're fixated on the business end first, maybe you should start a game company, but it doesn't mean you should also be designing games. Doing both is way too much work.
Right. Yeah. For me, I would definitely be bringing in the business side experience rather than the game design experience. But
And what I'm doing now, like CheapAss Games is in St. Louis now. I don't really take much of a hand in it. I'm kind of doing that again. I'm doing Crab Fragment Labs, which is a springboard for new ideas, but like I'm not dealing with manufacturing at all. Some of our games can be done on a print on demand site called Drive Through Cards, but most of them are all just print and play. Like, this is a game, full stop. Play it, enjoy it, send us a dollar if you like it. But that is kind of liberating because now I can just not worry about what publisher I have to satisfy or you know, what print deadline I have to make or whether my games are going to be stuck in a 1,000 ship backup at LA, right?
Like, yeah, no kidding. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Well, what are you playing? Like, what do you put on the table, you know, most often these days, or are you stuck in kind of the design?
I am playing a lot of video games. I'm still playing a lot of Animal Crossing. It's a fun toy. You know, I play casino games on my handheld, and mostly what I'm spreading on the table is stuff that I'm working on. Like, that's just, that's always been the majority of what gets played in my house is games that are not done yet. and that's weird because like the frame of mind that puts me in is I'm no fun to play a board game with because if you break out Quacks of Quedlinburg or whatever, you know, and we play that, I'm going to spend the whole game talking about how it could have been better because that's the mindset that I'm at. Like, I'm always editing, I'm always fixing, I'm always why is this rule like this? Why is this character like this? Everything is why with me. And if you're a player, like the way I enjoy movies is to sit back and let them flow over me. And so, cause I'm not a movie maker, right? But as a game designer, my experience with every new game is I treat it like it's still in playtest.
Yeah. Now, is your family your playtest group, or you got a group of friends there that you're able to?
COVID has sort of screwed up everything. My daughter Nora is definitely my most frequent playtester now because we are in the same bubble. But previously to that, for the entire lifespan of CheapAss Games, I had a weekly game night that was comprised of about a dozen or so friends, local gamers, and so forth, who were real at the headwaters of every new development. And then whenever I went to a convention, I pulled people to play the game as often as I could. So I'm always sitting down with new people and new players when the opportunity is there.
Definitely. Were you able to get to Gen Con this year?
I was not willing to get to Gen Con this year. Fair.
It's a little up in the air.
Yeah, it is.
It's good. At least we're starting to reintegrate back. So I was, pull us off the topic to a fun side thing and maybe, looking at the development of our careers as they go. But it was funny to see, you know, your early kind of focus was nothing to do with games, but was juggling. So
true.
I want to ask you, I want to tell us a little bit about that. And kind of, it's funny, the Wikipedia page reads very funny. It reads as if you had an early career in juggling and then you were hired by Wizards of the Coast to juggle. And I was like, oh, somebody needs to work on their grammar there.
I did actually do a couple of juggling jobs for Wizards. I mean, you know, we're all friends here. It's a small industry. And the Wikipedia page desperately needs work. There's a much more good, much more girderer bio at Crab Fragment. Yeah. So forgot to go pick that up. But anyway, I started my professional career as an entertainer. I was a magician as a child. You know, I learned to juggle when I was like 13. I spent my teens in the SCA, which is a medieval reenactment group where you get to dress up and play with swords and in my case, juggle at feasts and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, entertainment was just a thing that I liked, the thing I knew how to do. I went to engineering school, but on the weekends I went to St. Louis and juggled in the train station and, you know, passed the hat. And when I moved to Seattle in 89, I actually took on a pen name. James Ernest is not my real name because there were three famous people in town with my real name, a weatherman, a congressman, and a serial killer. And I didn't want to be confused with any of them. But I think what's important about this backstory is that I'm an entertainer. And I think that is a part of game invention that can't be overlooked. Mm. I have to remember that every game that we make is really about an audience experience. It has to be interpreted through their eyes, and it has to be, you know, straight up entertaining for them. The cheap ass line specifically is about why. It's about, why am I playing this game? What is the joke on the front of this envelope that's going to make me spend $5 to try what's inside of it? And therefore, what am I as a player pretending to do? So that's always been my gateway to a new game, is what am I about to pretend to do?
Yeah.
It's also, from a design standpoint, if you're actually modeling a real world system and you can tell your players what system that is, then they bring a whole bunch of rules in that you don't have to teach them again. As opposed to a purely abstract game that models nothing, where you have to start from scratch, that's a harder learning curve. That's a bigger first step. And so when I say, you know, you're sneaking around a house trying to kill somebody, that helps me explain why when he can't see you, you can do stuff that you can't do when he does see you. Like, okay, that's just like when I really sneak around somebody's house and try to kill them.
You're channeling that that serial killer part of your
absolutely
your alternate personality. Too funny. And yeah, kind of as I've grown, it's interesting kind of reflecting back on just kind of education and what is important in that education and applying it to real world experience. And there's so many people that have that kind of story of, you know, of these specialties in such disparate areas, you know, and how they apply it. And it really fascinates me. I mean, ultimately, I graduated with a psychology degree. And so just kind of why people do the things they do is generally fascinating
and
to me.
And people can't even explain why they do the things they do. And,
yeah,
and that, you know, so it's, psychology is a crazy science.
Definitely.
I tell you, a lot of people come to game design through entertainment. More people, I think, come to it through math and the hard sciences. And I think that because the defining aspect of games is their mechanics, it's easy to forget that they have all these other aspects that they share with other media and to say that mechanics are the only thing that matters. And so there's a whole lot of game designers, especially, you know, when you meet new game designers who are coming at it from that perspective and they want to make a game, and what they think a game is a set of rules, which, you know, ignoring all the aspects of marketing and manufacturing, but just like, here is a set of rules. It is therefore a game. Like, they sort of miss the experience that a player is having when they adopt the game, when they learn the game, when they teach the game, when they think about the game.
Yeah.
You know, those are often much more soft sciences than rules and numbers and writing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, my recent, you know, game commitment has been Flesh and Blood, and certainly a very well-designed card game. But what drew me to that game was the value and the energy and effort they put into the competitive side, the organized play side, you know, because for me, I play games these days mainly for the social side, you know, and I pick games that I can resonate with and enjoy, certainly, you know, that certainly helps me stick around. But to see that, and I think that that's something that I would like to see in BattleTech. You know, I have my own ideas for kind of ways to kind of bring that into fruition. But, you know, one of the things that, BattleTech doesn't have is just that, is an ease to get people together and play in kind of an organized fashion. And so that's something kind of in terms of me, in terms of my own, you know, personal goals and ideas, that's something I have on my mind to kind of address, is find that way to kind of bring people together. But it's good to,
and it's good to put that as a high level goal in your design plan. Like, that doesn't happen automatically. You have to know you want it.
Yeah. And you have to put in, I mean, the logistics of that and organizing that are incredible. You know, but as you said, it's you know, it is two completely different worlds between designing and creating the game and actually distributing the game, producing the game. You know, it's insane, and it's you know, it's somewhat frustrating. BattleTech's, you know, in a big resurgence now, you know, coming off a very successful Kickstarter 2 years ago. It's interesting to me, having run a business and kind of watch people give feedback and, you know, as customers, and vent frustrations and, you know, share, you know, positive feedback as well as negative feedback. If, you know, it's always amazed me how alien the reality of producing a product and getting it to market and delivering it to the customers, how that reality is so alien to the consumer of that product and how.
Sure. Well, and, but yeah, they don't need to know how the sausage is made, but
yeah,
but yeah, it's again, you're delivering for them an experience. They,
yeah,
they see a game on a store shelf and they buy it and play it.
Yeah. I see it more on the empathy side and kind of managing expectations because you want people yeah. to enjoy it, you know, and you don't want them to be like, oh, why isn't this on the shelf? And it's like, yeah. well, that's because it's floating in the harbor off of California. You know, yeah. That's why it is. But yeah, it's crazy. So what's, you know, what are you working on now? You got a game kind of in development, or are you kind of in the design and play testing with your daughter?
At the moment, I have several games. We just sent out the Crab Fragment newsletter for this month, and mm-hmm. I have three games that are about to drop, and they're all sort of different shapes and sizes. But the first one is called Vines, and it's a collection of trick-taking games. Speaking of Magic the Gathering style deck building, when you make a traditional style trick-taking game, the deck construction rules are pretty simple. You just set up a rule and then build that deck, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I've really enjoyed doing games in that category, games that are with what is essentially a traditional style deck, maybe five suits, maybe six or three or whatever, but whatever that introduces to the games. Mm-hmm. Vines is a set of trick-taking games that I did for basically on spec, like I do many times, a project that finally just evaporated, and now I have it, and I love these games, so that's coming out, and I'm actually working on the art right now to get the cards ready for a proof. There is a city building game, sort of a tile laying game called Copper Creek, which is actually like 15 years old at this point. It was just one of these back burner games that was never quite right. And this year we took it out and made it a little closer to right. So that's another game that will be print and play, on Crab Fragment pretty soon. And the other one is, I don't know if you're familiar with TAC. It's a game that I did out of a science fiction or fantasy novel with Patrick Rothfuss. That got me a few other leads, including this one called The Verdigris Pawn, which is a YA novel that just came out this summer that is sort of chock full of references to this chess game. And the author of the book said, I would love it if this chess game was a real thing. And so we are about to drop the open beta rules for Fist is the name of the game. It is a asymmetric chess variant. So, you know, the king has lots of pieces and the challenger has a fewer pieces, but they can do more things.
Okay.
And so that is another game where I don't have to manufacture it because you can play it with the chess set. So we're just putting the rules out. The author's main objective is to have a set of rules that she can sort of share with the people who are reading the book. My objective is, of course, to find a publisher for this thing and actually make some money on it.
Yeah, yeah.
That'll happen after we get the rules down.
Definitely.
So yeah, I got a bunch of stuff going on. Those are just the three hottest topics right now.
And where do people find those? What are the links and stuff?
Crab Fragment Labs is the website. crabfragment.com will get you there. And that's all games by me, mostly print and play. Some of them are also available from drive-through carts.
Awesome. And is Crab Fragment kind of a subsidiary of Cheapass? You know, what's the relationship?
That's a replacement. Cheapass Games got bundled up and shipped to St. Louis about 2 years ago. We took essentially Greater Than Games is a game publisher in St. Louis, has done many things you have heard of. And we were looking to get out of the publishing business. Luckily, before COVID, before, you know, the most recent shipping and manufacturing issues that came up, we said, at some point we have to retire. And so my wife and I looked around for a publisher to take the catalog and Greater Than did. They continue now with those things. And Crab Fragment is full stop, brand new stuff that didn't go out the door with that delivery.
Gotcha. Excellent. And, you know, for people out there that are listening that are interested in kind of diving into the industry, you know, any kind of suggestions, you know, as a veteran, kind of for people, you know, where do they go, you know, where to look, how to look, what kind of things to avoid kind of in the industry?
As publishing, as designing?
As developing. I think as designing, developing.
As designing, the common wisdom is that to make a lot of games, you have to play a lot of games. And I don't 100% agree with that. I certainly have played a lot of games in my life and I continue to do that, but you can't really learn without also making a lot of games, like just literally crank them out. And that's why I tell people, don't get distracted by selling it to a publisher. Don't get distracted by manufacturing it. Make games. The first things that we did as game designers was kit bashing stuff we already have. I changed the rules to every game in my house. I changed the rules to Monopoly. I changed the rules to D&D. I changed the rules to chess, right? I just, you know, monkey with what you have, play it with people and see if it got better. And eventually learn those steps that take you from an idea in your head to a board game you can play with friends. But let it stop there and do that 100 times. When I taught a game design class, I was just like, you're going to make a new game every week. We did that every week for a whole semester. Just crank them out, because you will learn a lot more finishing a lot of short projects than dragging yourself through one long project.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
On the education side, are there specific fields and focuses that you find excel more? You know, I know you talked about kind of the math and engineering as one that people come into, but not necessarily the recommended one. You know, what kind of backgrounds do you find, you know, create the best designers?
It depends on what kind of game you want to make, right?
Yeah.
Games is such a broad category. I have a background in math and entertainment. I'm a technical writer. I'm a graphic designer. I have sort of all the chops to make my own things. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't hurt to dip your feet in all of those things. You should at least, read a little bit about math as it specifically applies to game design. I have some articles at Crab Fragment that sort of touch those areas. I just posted a video last year about graphic design for game designers, very specifically how to make prototypes that work better. It's not about finished products. It's just about laying out the information on a card, you know? But mostly you learn by doing. And game design, if you're used to another creative process like painting or writing or almost any other form of art, you typically don't involve people in your process. You show them something that's done or close to done. You get editorial feedback, but you can't really get someone's feedback on your idea.
Right.
The process of game design, at least for me, is much different from that, because I will workshop names of games. I will workshop core mechanics. I will put components in front of people and say, what would you do with these? And that leads to much better products than if I sat at my desk writing a game down to its last details and then put it in front of somebody. That product always sucks. I did it a couple of years ago at a convention. I wrote a card game that I didn't have any testers, so I just wrote this whole thing and put it in front of people, and it was awful. And just one more reinforcement of, for game design specifically, to understand how people will approach what you're building and what they want to do with it, what they expect it to do. You can put it in front of people pretty early in the development, and they will help you a lot. So that's maybe the most important thing for a new designer to understand, is that you cannot retire to an ivory tower and poop out a game. You really have to put the structure in front of people, understand what they expect, take their feedback seriously. And the less you work on something, the less attached you are to it, the more likely it is you'll be willing to change it into something better. You know, because if you do work in that tower for a year and then put your game in front of somebody and they don't like it, you will just reject their feedback and move on to a tester who does. Like, that's no way to run a railroad, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, that resonates with one of my favorite quotes that I have as a professional, is that, you know, perfection is the enemy of progress. And it seems like that's kind of, you know, that's exactly what you're saying. It's just like,
absolutely. The number one reason I procrastinate is fear of doing it wrong. And you just, you only overcome that by getting in there and getting your hands dirty.
Definitely. Excellent. Well, I appreciate this conversation, James. Before I sign off, are there any videos of you showing off your juggling skills that we can watch?
Actually,
stuff?
You can find a lot of miscellaneous things on my YouTube channel. They're all linked from Crab Fragment, mostly in the About page and over on the lecture pages. It's a mix of travel videos with the family. There is a video of me juggling at a Ren Faire a few years ago. There is a number of just how to make your own board games and you know, playing cards and so forth. And you should also check out my podcast, which I do every week. It's called Here All Week. And my friend Kelly Wright and I decided that during the pandemic, we would sit down in front of a microphone for half an hour every week and tell each other jokes. So that's
I love it. Yeah, Renegade HPG is a COVID baby, so it was a good time for people to kind of come up and exercise some ideas. Definitely kind of get the podcast up and going. So, what are the links for that? Certainly people can find that on iTunes, Spotify, I assume, and any kind of social media links that people can check out in addition to
everything front page at Crab Fragment. That's your excellent anchor for all that good stuff.
Excellent. Well, I will definitely be checking that out and kind of exploring some of those YouTube videos. So I appreciate your time, James. And no, it's been fun. Get a little glimpse into BattleTech history and get a little
insight thanks for having
into
me.
Kind of how games are met. I appreciate it.
I wish that I could tell you of all the years that I worked on that game, but sadly they were cut short.
but it led to good things. It led to good things. And so a lot of good games have come out of you since, but we appreciate it. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
Bye.